On Monday, August 8th, Tall Can Audio hits 1,000 episodes.
Wait, that's still on? Who could possibly still care?
And the gang is all here to celebrate.
It's euphoric. It's got to be close to nirvana. It's outstanding.
For the first time ever, Maddie, Michaela, Rob, and Matt are all live in studio together.
It's happening, you guys! It's happening! Oh, my God, guys! Oh, my God! I wish you all were here!
Is this likely to go well?
Just check my notes here. No!
At least it will make a lot of noise.
Boom. Here comes the boom.
1,000 pods and 1,000 pints.
I don't think I've ever been as proud in my entire life.
TCA 1000 drops Monday, August 8th, wherever you find low-quality podcasts.
Fuck, it's out of control. Shit.
One represents a Canada of about 50 years ago,
yeah.
And one represents Canada of today and tomorrow.
It's true.
One has a future, one doesn't.
I'm not sure what the f*** this is. I'm about to find out.
This is Tall Can Audio.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back into the Tall Can Audio podcast. Matt Robinson here with you in the TCA studios. Make sure you give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram. We are at Tall Can Audio. Facebook.com/TallCanAudio. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you're listening to this one. I'm really happy to be welcoming to the show today author of the book Before the Lights Go Out, A Season Inside a Game on the Brink, and of course from The Athletic, Sean Fitzgerald's here. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
I really appreciate you coming on. I know the book's been out for a while, but I just read it. I've been getting a lot of reading done during the pandemic. My Amazon wish list is just completely wiped out as I've been stuck home here for a while. So I checked it out over the summer, and then I saw you tweeted out the other day that now available in paperback. So I thought, well, what better time, right, to maybe do this? I guess a little bit before we get to the book, I'd like to ask you about an article you just posted this week about the East York Hockey Association. And, you know, one of the very first minor hockey associations to shut down due to COVID. I've got that right, don't I? They're not the first. There was one other one.
There was Amesbury, which is in the west end of the city, and East York is the biggest because they represent about 850 kids from age 4 to, I believe it's 18.
Yeah, and for those, you know, listening outside of Ontario, our numbers here are exploding. I can't help but wonder if we're not about to be locked down again or at least rolled back a phase or two here. But what went into their decision to, you know, eventually roll this back? I'm sure the climbing numbers were one of them, but there's a lot that has to go into something like that with dues already paid and you know, people signed up. What's that decision look like?
Yeah, it's a difficult one for sure. So, I mean, there's a lot of themes that even if you are listening outside of Ontario, there's a lot of themes here that would repeat and look familiar to anybody who's sort of involved in minor hockey that, you know, East York, its board is, you know, there's about 22 volunteers, including conveners and, you know, the board secretary. But they've all been around for a very long time. You know, many of them are now senior citizens, and they've had a lot of trouble, you know, over the years attracting new blood. So what you have is you have a group of these volunteers who have to make a decision that nobody in the last 100 years has had to make of how do you proceed during a pandemic. So, you know, you throw in the liability question. And in Ontario, this still hasn't been answered for, you know, provincial sports organizations of, you know, should something happen and should some, God forbid, somebody get sick and give it to a parent or a grandparent who becomes desperately ill or perhaps even dies or takes it into work and causes another knock-on economic shutdown, who's liable? So is the board liable? Is the president liable? That hasn't been tested yet. So you have that. And then you have, you know, the immediate moral implications of, you know, because there are so many senior citizens on the board and some of them are living with real serious health concerns. And two of them, in the case of East York, go home to people who are living with cancer. So what is your moral implication there of running hockey, not school, not work, but hockey? Mm-hmm. And what's the risk of getting somebody sick? And then, you know, the other one is, you know, Connie Mitchell, the president, was weighing, you know, because this is hockey, could she, at the end of the day, live with this on her conscience that, you know, little Jenny or little Jimmy comes to the rink, gets sick, passes it on to a grandfather, grandmother, elderly relative who dies, all for hockey. How could you live with yourself for that? And those are just some of the things that went into the decision.
Yeah, and I think for a few people that I've spoken to, right, guilt is maybe the strongest motivator for a lot of things, not going out. Even if you're not worried about getting it yourself, that thought of, okay, but if I took it home or if I took it wherever, like how do you kind of come back for that just for a night out or, like you said, a hockey game or whatever might be going on? Do you think this is going to be something that we see more of, that if not mandated by the government, do you think other associations will follow, or is it going to be kind of scattered here?
Yeah, I think it'll be scattered. I think it'll be region by region. That if you're up in Thunder Bay or you're up in Peterborough, and there haven't been many cases. Although, I mean, in central Ontario, there's been a couple of high schools in Peterborough that are reporting cases now. So, if you're in an area of the province that is relatively untouched, and you're a pretty small association, life might even continue on fairly close to normal. But in Toronto, if we follow the models that are out there about, by Thanksgiving, which is only a little, maybe a week or two away now, if we're up to 1,000 cases a day and, 500 cases a day in Toronto, there are going to have to be some hard decisions made. And there are, minor hockey associations still out there across Toronto that are on the fence, sort of waiting and seeing what happens with the possibility that they could pull the chute as well, because they decide it's just not worth the risk.
Yeah, one of the interesting things you mentioned in the article that I hadn't considered, it should be so secondary, but it makes sense when you're, dealing with people's money, is the idea that if we don't cancel now, like once you book all this ice time and the government doesn't force you to shut down, that money's gone, right? So even if you have to shut down later or decide to shut down later, you're out a lot of cash. So, I mean, even on a financial sense, you got to make some decisions right now, which is putting a lot of pressure on a lot of people, I would think.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, again, these are volunteers. Like, these aren't people who are CFOs at a major company who are used to dealing with this kind of risk, right? And navigating the risk of, well, will the city give you a credit for next year? Mm-hmm. Will it hold the money and say, well, it's not our fault. We gave you the ice. You couldn't use it. There's so many things on top of the primary concern, as you rightly pointed out, which is the health and well-being of everybody who's participating. But there's the knock-on business effects. And, some of these leagues have already ordered jerseys and socks, and that's tens of thousands of dollars. So, there is a lot at play here. There's a lot of moving parts.
Let's talk about the book. Hopefully something a little more enjoyable here. Like I said, it's called
The Withering of Hockey in Canada. Well, let's get into the enjoyable part.
And even the title here, as I run it back for people who haven't read it yet, kind of tells you that you might be in for a dark read at points. But it is, like I said, a season inside a game on the brink, which, Before the Lights Go Out, obviously, is the main title. But and you should be careful of that if you're looking for it on Amazon. Right underneath, the second option is Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. So make sure you grab the right one. It's a very different read.
Grab them both. Why not? Sure. What the hell? It's still a pandemic. Lots of time to read.
We'll share all the links in our places here so people can check it out. We're getting towards that stocking stuff for time of year and all these sorts of things. It's a good read, and I want to ask you about the concept of it. And I guess just to make people familiar, you spent a year with the Peterborough Petes and the season that they were kind of having. But as the book goes on, you're sort of weaving in and out of the story of the Pete season, but also where the game is at in this country, why registration numbers might be down, how new Canadians might feel about the sport, whether they've embraced it or haven't felt welcome around it. And so it covers a lot of ground. And I wonder where the concept to do something like that came from. It's one thing to just write a book about how the Pete season went, or the other side of it that I mentioned there. How do you decide to sort of intertwine them, and where does the idea and the concept come from?
It starts at a pub on King Street West with a lot of beers and a book editor who has a corporate credit card.
Where all the best ideas start.
Yeah. I mean, this was 2016. So to back it up just a little bit, it was August 2016, and I was playing hockey shinny at Maple Leaf Gardens. So Mattamy Athletic Center, it's now home to the Ryerson University. It's a wonderful mixed-use facility. It's the center ice is about three stories north of the cheese aisle at a Loblaws. So I was skating, and again, it's shinny, so you run a helmet, gloves, skates, that's it. And because I am a graceful swan, I just somehow tripped over the blue line. Like, literally just tripped over the blue line. I wasn't going fast, nothing crazy, but I land on my elbow, and it was like driving your elbow into a bowl of dried Rice Krispies. Like, you just feel like snap, crackle, pop, and then like a lot of profanity. So yeah. I get up, and our eldest, he was about, what was he? He would have been about 5 or 6. And he was in the stands that day, just hanging out, watching daddy play hockey, and sees daddy goes down like he was shot. So I get up. I'm like, don't scream. Don't say anything. I get up, go straight to the dressing room. And I look, and there's basically like a golf ball that's turning into a cricket ball right on my elbow. I'm like, well, crap. So anyway, I'll condense the story a bit. That was a Saturday. Go to the hospital. They take me right in, which is never a good sign. And the short version is that I, you know, on Sunday, I get reconstructive surgery on a shattered right elbow. So Monday I get home, I am floating along on painkillers. And Tuesday I get a call from the Toronto Star, where I worked, to say that we're very sorry, but we're going through a round of layoffs and you're part of it because you're at the bottom of the union. So I've been at National Post for 15 years, moved to the Star, and I got whacked while floating along watching Black Mass with Johnny Depp in a darkened basement on Percocet. So,
good week.
You know, yes, it's a great week. And also, my sister, because I'd never seen them in person, my sister had somehow finagled 2 tickets to go watch The Tragically Hip in one of their last shows at Air Canada Centre.
Ooh, nice.
That I had to pass up on because that was the Wednesday night, and I had a shattered elbow and lots of Percocets in my back pocket, so I couldn't go. Anyway, so a couple weeks after
this
that,
is getting more and
finally,
more tragic as we
go. I'm getting back up onto my feet. I am without a job. I have a shattered right elbow. And Jordan Ginsburg, who's an editor with Penguin Random House, McClellan Stewart, gives me a call and says, hey, how'd you like to meet up for some beers? I'm like, I like beer and I like free beer. So we go, and he sits down, and we float. He floats the concept. He doesn't tell me anything about writing a book. He's like, you know, what do you think about sort of hockey in Canada? And I'm like, well, you know, we have one child in minor hockey system, and I've covered it for years, and our daughter's, you know, heading down the path to getting into hockey school, and it's facing challenges. It's not resonating with Canadians today as it did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. There's lots of changes. Mm-hmm. And he just keeps sort of teasing it out, the idea of, well, how do we illustrate that? And, you know, 2 or 3 or 10 beers later, we come up with the idea of, you know, where is Hockey Town Canada, right? Like, you know, Detroit likes to proclaim itself Hockey Town USA. Buffalo lays a claim. There's a bunch of hockey towns. Where's the one in Canada? Mm-hmm. So we start bouncing around ideas. And, you know, is it Saskatoon? You know, home of the Saskatoon Blades, home of Gordie Howe. Is it Halifax, which is, you know, home to Nathan MacKinnon and Sidney Crosby and, you know, arguably the birthplace of the game? Right. Is it Montreal? And eventually we whittled it down to Peterborough, Ontario, which is home to the Peterborough Petes, which is one of the oldest. It calls itself the oldest continuously operating franchise in Canadian Hockey League. And it's just sort of that town where, you know, everybody seems to have a connection to the Petes, even if you don't like hockey.
Right.
Like your neighbor played for the Petes, your uncle played for the Petes, or, you know, your aunt sold concessions or worked in the front office at the Petes. So we settled on Peterborough. And what we did was we explored a lot of the broader concepts that we were talking about over our 10 or 20 beers and and explored them through the lens of the Peterborough Petes and Peterborough, using Peterborough as sort of a proxy for the rest of Canada, as it had been, you know, business-wise. That, you know, for years, if Tim Hortons wanted to test a Timbit that might sell well in Prince Rupert or St. John's or Halifax, it would test market it in Peterborough because a lot of the elements, economically and otherwise, in Peterborough sort of represented the rest of Canada. It had a broad manufacturing base once, and that's changed over the years, just like the rest of Canada. So Peterborough,
sort of political thing. Is it Ontario?
Exactly.
They win Ontario. Whoever wins Peterborough seems to win the Ontario election,
and federally.
Is it federal too?
Yeah, it's something like 16 of the last 17 provincial elections. And if your party wins the seat in Peterborough, you form the majority.
Right.
And it's something like 10 of the last 11 federally that if you win Peterborough, you form the government in Ottawa.
Wow. It's an interesting thing. I'm an Oshawa guy, so no love for the Petes. born and raised there as a Jen East fan. But it's an interesting way to, you know, you are talking about, you know, a classic old arena you're talking about to get anywhere, long bus trips. It is sort of the story.
Except Oshawa. You can basically roll downhill and end up in Joshua.
That's true. You sort of get this classic junior hockey perspective with the old barn and the bus trips and the small town and everything that kind of goes into that. Were they receptive right away to the idea? I know you spent quite a bit of time with them and interviewing a lot of people there riding around on the bus. Were they into it?
You know what? I wasn't sure what to expect. That was the first step. So one of the first calls I made was to Burton Lee, who is now their grand poobah of business. I can't remember what his title then was, but it might be grand poobah now. You have to check his business card. And I did, you know, I went and he was very gracious and met for lunch at a really cool Peterborough downtown restaurant that I didn't know existed. And just sort of laid out like, look, like I'm, you know, not out to do a hit job. I just want to really honestly sort of immerse myself in this market and get a sense of what hockey is like in a place that, I mean, for years, Peterborough was the hotbed, you know, for hockey and for innovation, for, you know, sending people directly from the Memorial Center to the NHL. Like, it was the place. And like hockey, there are a lot of indications that it's lost its way. And, you know, what Burton did was he's like, yeah, he, on nothing more than a guarantee that I would do my best to just report the truth, he said yes. And what that meant was I, you know, slowly got more, I got access to the arena, to meeting people, to sort of, you know, hanging around for that playoff run before. So I was going to follow them the following season and they were just heading into the playoffs that year. So I sort of lurked around in the background and slowly introduced myself to Mike Oak, the general manager, and Dave Pogue, the president, and Jody Hull, who was the coach, and met some of the parents and the Billets, and, you know, just sort of said, hey, look, you know, I'm Sean Fitzgerald. I've, you know, 15 years at National Post, the Toronto Star, and now I'm working for this thing called The Athletic. And just sort of let them know what I'm about and, you know, sort of the story that I'm looking to tell. And at that point, I wasn't sure what the story was going to be. I just knew I wanted to talk to them and learn about their experiences. And over time, you know, they let me in. I got to ride the bus. I got to hang out, you know, in the coach's office for hours and hours and hours and, you know, hang out in the coach's film room and, you know, go to practices and, you know, go to players meetings where they, you know, met bankers to talk about things like retirement savings plans and, you know, people like, you know, sports psychologists to hang in on all those sessions and meet people in and out of the building and really get a sense of who was playing for the Peets, who loved the Peets, who didn't care about the Peets. And I got to spend a lot of time and meet a lot of really interesting people up there.
What did you get in terms of, a month or two ago on this show now, kind of debated the merits of the old barn versus the new flashy arena. And again, as an Oshawa guy, I grew up seeing games at the Civic, and then 06, maybe it was, they built a new arena there. Certainly here in Ottawa, they did a nice job renovating the Civic. London, big building, you know, and Peterborough has sort of lagged back into this sort of classic old barn. You still got the Queen looking down at you over the ice. I wonder just in that kind of general sense about arenas, what you think the value is. There's kind of a history when you go and see the game, and it's still, you can smell the locker room when you walk in the door, and versus, you know, would they prefer to get something nice and new built, or they kind of like having the old classic barn?
Oh shit. They would sell us both up the river to get a new barn right now. Like, and I mean that in the nicest, most respectful way possible. That the Peets are sort of stuck in this spot that Peterborough is a really conservative town. And I'm not saying that like politically, I'm just saying that they move slowly, glacially sometimes, right? Like they've been discussing a new crosstown traffic artery for almost as long as you and I have been alive combined.
Right.
Like they, you know, there's been talk about, you know, maybe putting it, and I know this is above, you know, Peterborough strictly, but there's been talk of putting a commuter rail line that goes through Peterborough again for about 1,000 years. They don't move quickly. So, you know, right around the time that Oshawa was talking about, you know, building a new arena, Peterborough was having that same discussion, but instead they decided to take the more conservative measure of pouring about, I think it was something like $13 or $16 million into the Memorial Center to make it less of a literal barn. And what they did was they They took out the stages and put in a restaurant, put in some private boxes, and, you know, basically putting a really nice shade of lipstick on an old pig.
Right.
And that's what they did. Whereas Oshawa went ahead and built GM, now Tribute, a wonderful arena with big seats, restrooms that don't smell like 100-year-old urine, and some concession stands. And not just concession stands where you're selling hot dogs and popcorn, but you can do a pretty good job of finding almost anything you want up there, right? It's a nice concession. Are the lines too long? Yes. Is the wait time too long? Yes. If you don't get there an hour before, are you going to get a seat in the restaurant? Probably not.
Right.
But it's not perfect, but it's also junior hockey. And it's once you get inside, it's comfortable. And more importantly, the Jennies can make a lot of money on a lot of that stuff. Whereas in Peterborough, like, there's one craft beer hut. If you want to line up to get a snack, you better start thinking about it with 10 minutes to go in the period. The bathrooms are very small. And if you're too tall, you're going to hit your head while you're hanging a whiz, right? Like, there's a lot of issues there. And they don't have a lot of ways that they can make a lot of money. They put in a new video board so that they call it activating sponsorship, which I hate, but it's like, you know, putting more basically corporate money into the place. But again, they have lease issues. The city takes a lot of the money. They need a new barn because they need one room for more people inside, two more modern ways to squeeze more money out of the community just to continue to stay competitive. Because you look at you look at Oshawa, you look at Windsor, as you mentioned, you look at London, Barrie, so many of these places have, I think Sudbury might be the only one with an older arena. And the Peach just get left further and further behind, which, you know, in a way is somewhat analogous to hockey in Canada, the story of hockey in Canada, that for years and years and years, the Peterborough Peach were able to say, look, it's winter, it's cold, literally what the hell else are you going to do other than come watch us play? So we're going to open the door, you're going to come in, you're going to watch us play, and that's enough. Whereas, you know, hockey for years and years and years says, look, Canada, it's cold. It's fall. You're not doing anything else this winter. So come play
Saturday
hockey
night. Come watch Ron and Don and the gang.
Exactly. Whereas now you can do anything. Like, there's soccer bubbles in small towns. You can play soccer. You can play indoor tennis. You can go swimming. You can play esports. You cannot play sports at all.
Yep.
You can sit home and watch YouTube, and you can do all of those things instead of play hockey. And you can do all of those things instead of going to watch the Peach. And around the same time, both the Peach and hockey in general, I'm speaking very broadly there, have realized that, holy crap, we've fallen behind the curve. How do we catch up and what do we need to do?
Yeah. And so it's interesting that they don't think it's classic and charming. They're just stuck. Like, they do.
They appreciate the history that you can walk down outside the Peach dressing room and they have the frame team photo of every team in history from the, you know, the mid 60s all the way up until today. And they have, you know, all those old banners. They have the portrait of the Queen. They have that feel like when there's a big game going on, it still feels unique. You're not in a cookie cutter rink. Like there's still some rinks like that that can get by. Like, you know, the Barn in Kitchener is a gorgeous rink, but it's also massive, and they've done a good job of sort of keeping with the time. So it doesn't feel like the cookie cutter rink. You know how like London's built to sort of resemble Air Canada Center, and like it feels kind of meh. Like, when you're in Peterborough, you goddamn well know you're playing the Peets, and you know those boards are still kind of square, and you know that the ice is 15 feet shorter than regulation, and you know that they're going to be right on top of you, and you know all of these things. You know very well that you have your place in time right now, and that's in Peterborough. But you can't make money doing that if you're the Peets.
Right. No, and I think the point you make there is an interesting one about how it is sort of analogous to the game in Canada, and that's one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. And there's a number of different chapters, and we don't have time to weave in and out all of them, obviously, and encourage people to pick up the book, do it for themselves. But one of the things that I found really interesting, and you touched on it a few different ways throughout the book, was this sense of community that maybe a lot of people don't even think about in terms of, you know, your kid, maybe, you know, he has his school friends, but now he has his hockey friends. And then mom and dad gets to know the hockey friends' parents. And now you're off at tournaments and you meet those people. And it creates this kind of, you at least always have that one thing to talk about. And you kind of create this social circle that comes out of it. And if you're a new Canadian or you're just not engaged in the sport, that maybe you don't speak that language, right? And it's one less way to end up kind of intertwined into the community.
No, that's exactly it. And that's a really good summary. That, you know, Dallas Eakins is now coaching the NHL, longtime NHL player, coach of the Toronto Marlies for a long time. He was born in Florida. Mm-hmm. And he'll describe it as like he's born in a part of Florida, central Florida, where like mom had a 22 by the door to pick off snakes if they came too close to the, like that's almost not even a joke, right? Like he lived near a big nature preserve. And when he was, I can't remember now, it was 7 or 8, maybe 9, you know, they picked up and they drove up to their new life in Canada, and they're going to settle in Peterborough. And he remembered, like, he played baseball as a kid, but there was no hockey in Florida back then. Mm. He remembers one of his very first memories of Peterborough was driving towards their house and going past some of the, you know, the roads leading up to their house and seeing kids outside playing ball hockey on the street. And it was through picking up a stick and just playing ball hockey on the street that he met kids, some that he'd go to school with, some who were just neighborhood kids who went to other schools. But that's how he met people in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That's how he learned what it was to be in Peterborough. Like you have those conversations, you know, hockey, other things. You learn more about the community. And he started playing ice hockey, started playing house league, and then learned, you know, that he wanted to wear that Pete's jersey because the Pete's, you know, at the single A, double A, triple level, you're the mini Pete's basically. Yeah. And he learned what it was to be from Peterborough, of Peterborough through hockey. And it's something that you're right, we do take for granted. Like there's even I've sort of talked about this a little bit, but even a personal example of, you know, we have two kids, and our eldest a couple of years ago was in grade 3, and his teacher knew that he was just mental for hockey. He played hockey, wore hockey stuff all the time. Like he loves PK Subban more than just about anything in the world. And the little boy had just moved with his family to Toronto from Vancouver. And he was wearing a Canucks hat.
Right.
So the teacher thought, well, might as well put the Canucks hat next to this idiot who always talks about hockey. And the next thing you know, it's like, I like Elias Pettersson. I like PK Subban. Are we best friends? We're best friends. And sure as shit, like they became absolutely inseparable. Mm-hmm. And we've now, like we have, even during the pandemic, we'll sit physically distant apart in each other's backyards.
Right.
While the kids, you know, sit around physically distant and hang out in the backyard. Like we've become friends with their family. So that family was able to move literally across the country and make friends and find an entry point in a new community through nothing more than hockey. Now, yeah, they might have found themselves, they might have found each other without hockey, but having hockey as that entry point sure as hell expedited that process.
Yeah, no doubt about it. One of the other interesting stories that you referenced was, I believe it was a meeting of the GTHL when Hockey Canada was trying to hand down the half ice hockey and explain all these things. And one of the things that I took away from it was you referenced one of the Hockey Canada employees talking to all these Toronto area coaches. And I hope I haven't got this. He referenced that we were now churning out high level hockey players at the same rate as like Sweden and Finland, and did it with like a sneer, like our population, this is our game, we have bigger populations, and now we're only ending up with the same number of high level players as these smaller countries. I wonder where you think from your research and stuff for putting the book together, how we've gotten there, how we're a country that identifies so much with hockey but have ended up at this place where we're churning out far fewer players than maybe we used to at a high level anyway.
Oh man, so this podcast we're allowed to go on for 4 hours, is
sure,
that
yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, all right, I'm gonna take a deep breath and I'm gonna talk for the next 3.5 hours. Man, like the short answer to that is we eat our young. And I think you're talking about Dr. Stephen Norris, who's sort of a sports scientist, as he likes to call himself. And he studies this. He studies trends. He studies numbers. He breaks down, you know, best practices, physiology, all of that stuff, and he throws it into a bag. And so he comes from a highly educated background there. The short answer is, yes, we eat our young. So what hockey does is hockey is an early entry sport. And by that, I mean, you know, you can potentially pick up basketball in high school or junior high, and you still have time to become an exceptional basketball player. You don't have to look a lot further than, I mean, granted, this is a very small sample size, but Pascal Siakam didn't start playing basketball until a very late age. And now he's an NBA champion and a potential future star with the Toronto Raptors. I mean, I say he's a star now, but his star could continue to grow. He didn't start playing till later. There are late entry sports. Football might be another one where you can pick it up in high school if you're a good athlete and really, really work, and you can get on that path. Hockey, if you start skating in high school, enjoy your beer league career. you're not going anywhere else.
Right.
So you have to learn how to skate. So the problem that's happened with hockey is that they start streaming kids out far too early. That if you reach 9, 10, and you're not already working out with a specialized skating instructor or a skills instructor, if you're not working power skating, if you're not on that treadmill to becoming really, really good, if people haven't earmarked you for AAA or you're something, you have to be really self-motivated to carry on yourself. Because if you are, you know, at a very young age, scoring lots of goals and you have a lot of those performance metrics working in your favor, it doesn't mean if, you know, you're a naturally great athlete or you have a lot of talent. It just means you developed earlier than your peers. So you're rewarded by being pushed further ahead on this treadmill. And that's great. Except what we're doing as a system is we're just pushing ahead the kids who are developing earlier.
Right.
That the kids who might be better athletes, who might end up being better at the sport, albeit just at a later age, are being streamed out. So they're not getting into those AAA programs. They're not being rewarded with this extra coaching. They're not being rewarded with the energy of you're going to be something, keep at it. And we're streaming them out to becoming maybe really good basketball players or really great volleyball players or whatever, but they're being beaten out of the system because we're streaming them because we're prizing results over potential development. We're prizing the 9-year-old or the 10-year-old or the 11-year-old who goes to a tournament and scores 10 goals in 4 games or 10 goals in a game and saying that kid's going to be a star, even though they might top out at like 5'3" and really learn to hate the game because they've had to play it year round. Whereas the kid, you know, who maybe didn't score or is kind of awkward because they've grown faster than their body can really handle it, maybe they're the ones who become the 6'2", you know, speed skating dynamo later, if only they've been given the chance. We're streaming kids out of the game too early. And that's just one of the issues. We're not even talking about time commitment demands on families. We're not even talking about the economics of it. Awesome. We're not even talking about the very existential point of this whole thing, which is the entry level, which is think of all the kids that we're not even allowing into the tent in the first place because maybe their families don't have a background in hockey, and look at all of this and say, you know what? This is fucking nuts, and I'm not subjecting my kid to that at all.
Right. Could you see a time? Are we on a path where, I mean, the Americans continue to get better and better and have more and more kids playing and just the resources there. And could you see a time where at the high level, at the World Juniors, at the Olympics, where we are more of a, I guess I already referenced it, a Finland, a Sweden, a, you know, who pops their head up now and then and wins something, but for the most part, it's run by the Americans. Are we on that path?
It's a really interesting question. Now, here's the doomsday scenario, if you want to take a big drink of pessimism here while listening to a podcast. We keep streaming kids out. We don't do a better job of attracting communities into the rinks who aren't always part of it, aren't already part of it. So, you know, new Canadians who have sort of, you know, not been affected or interested in hockey. You don't do a better job of increasing your grassroots numbers. So there's that. So you're losing all of those folks. And as it is, Hockey Canada registration has been stagnant for years, even as Canada's population continues to grow. So you can say, well, they're holding firm. They're holding the line. Well, no. Every year that you don't increase your registration, you're losing your percentage share of the Canadian population. So there's that.
Yep.
Then you're like, well, you know what? If I'm in a hockey bubble, my kid plays hockey. Hockey dictates our whole life. Through the winter, through the spring, we're doing hockey. We're hanging out with all our hockey buddies. Hockey's never been more popular. Well, okay, fine. So you're in that bubble and you identify yourself as one of those Joe Canadians who really gets sort of weepy over the beer commercials every time you show, this is our game.
Yeah.
Okay, so you identify, you're this is our game kind of camp, right? That's fine. And historically, obviously, that's been true. But, you know, take a look at the women's game. The women's game, how many years have the Americans won a world championship over Canada
Most
over the last 10?
Seems like,
yes.
Yeah.
And now you look at that skill from the last Winter Olympic Games and you go, holy sweet creeping Jesus. Like they have the Lambert, they have, like we had Marie-Philippe Poulin who was injured and, you know, a few others, Natalie Spooner, but on a skill to skill level, holy crap, were the Americans far ahead of us. So, and you start looking at the Americans, I mean, you know, in the first all-star voting or, you know, there weren't, I don't think there was a single Canadian in the top 10
right.
for some of the NHL all-star ballots. So say we don't win another gold medal in women's hockey for another two or three Olympic cycles. Mm-hmm. That's 8 to 12 years. Say the Americans keep pumping out Austin Matthews and Jack Eichel and all the other Americans to our like one Connor McDavid and Nathan MacKinnon.
Yep.
Like, you know, the numbers just, it starts skewing. So say, yeah, this is our game. You're an our game guy. But all of a sudden, the Americans are winning all the time. So you can't have those beer commercials saying this is our game
right.
if we're, you know, a second or third place country. So what does that do for fan avidity? Does that say, well, it's not our game anymore, so we start moving on to something we do? Like all of a sudden,
well, that's you see such
Jamal,
an inter-
you see, yeah,
that's
you
see such Jamal an interesting Murray point. Eh? It's yeah. easy when you win all the time to be. I love the World Juniors. If you're just tuning in every Boxing Day to watch your team get your ass kicked, you're probably going to stop. At least some people yeah. are.
Absolutely.
It chips away.
All of a sudden, you're like, hey, Jamal Murray's from Kitchener.
Yeah.
Let's go play basketball. Or, and again, it's only one out of literally 38 million of us. But like Alphonso Davies.
Yep.
Right? Like all of a sudden, you can see that Canadians can do this
or
stuff.
Or Shapovalov. And like,
yeah.
it doesn't, Bianca, like...
Brooke Henderson.
Sure.
Like, there's lots of stuff that Canadians can do all of a sudden. It doesn't have to be spending $10,000 a year chasing a frozen rubber disc from literally, like, you know, August through June.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if you think, or obviously as you've kind of done this, there must have been a bunch of things that jumped out at you, but what was the most surprising thing you learned through the project, whether it was while you were riding around with the Peds or doing the research for the numbers around Canadian hockey? What was maybe the one thing that stuck with you the most that kind of either it was alarming or encouraging or, but one way or another, surprising?
I hadn't spent a lot of time around junior hockey before this, you know, because I did sort of just sort of luck into a couple of jobs here in Toronto that I sort of went straight from journalism school to covering professional sports. And my background, you know, for years and years was covering football. So, and I sort of had a dalliance with hockey. So riding the bus with the Peds and hanging around with the Peds, it either never dawned on me or I really hadn't realized it, but like at that age, they're still just kids. And I think, especially when you're watching the World Juniors, you really do forget that, you know, some of these kids miss curfew. Some of these kids, yeah, they still sneak out and grab some pops and come home hammered at 3 o'clock in the morning. Some of these kids struggle with school. Some of these kids are, you know, just getting their driver's license or having their first serious girlfriend or, you know, dealing with adversity while mom and dad are FaceTime because they're on the other side of the continent as opposed to being right here. Like, they have a lot on their plate, whereas, you know, I'm so used to seeing them on television, you know, being cut at 5 in the morning
right.
back when TSN used to carry that. And yeah. well, it's like, of course, how can you screw that up against the Russians, blah, blah, blah. But they're still just kids.
Yeah.
And the pressures that we put on them, having put all the pressure already to get through AAA just to get to the OHL is enormous. And you can start to see who's getting streamed out and what kind of families are left and what kind of families have sort of been left by the wayside.
Yeah, it's kind of skewed by television a little bit. I've had a thing for a while, a personal rule, I guess, when I'm watching the Generals, or it's harder with the World Juniors, I guess, because of the Maple Leaf and the big deal that you make out of. But I'll cheer like crazy, but I'm not booing a teenager. As a grown man, I can't bring myself to go to a Generals game, get drunk, and boo some 17-year-old. Like it feels wrong in some sort of way, right? Like you do have to sort of keep in mind the age of it and. You know, we were just seeing, I guess, over the last couple of days, the Q's talking about increasing penalties for fighting in hockey. There's been some talk that the OHL might have to do it, too, under the guise of COVID. I'm fine with that, too. I don't need to see some 17-year-olds punching each other in the face. Like, it feels kind of strange, eh? But when they're on TV and they're playing in front of 5,000 people, you kind of lose track sometimes that they are just kids still. They are still that young.
Yeah, if you're going to get drunk and boo somebody, just make sure it's the OAs. Just make sure it's the overagers.
Sure.
That's fine. That's fine. They can vote. They can vote. They're old enough to handle it.
Probably
get drunk and boo the OAs.
Come up in the stands and kick my ass, probably. I guess I sort of cut you off there a minute ago. I did have one other question on this that maybe you were already sort of heading to. And I wonder, as we sort of struggle with the idea of where the game fits in terms of where our performance might go as a country, where do you think our fandom might go as a country? And you were sort of pointing out that if we become bad at it, maybe we'll care less. But do you see a time where maybe the NHL does end up kind of behind the Raptors or TFC or whatever it might be? Are we on that kind of path in terms of even spectators?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because the Raptors are still just in Toronto. Yeah. But you can't, and hockey is still hockey. I'm not saying I can see it's going to evaporate tomorrow, but I'm saying that the trends, these are generational trends that, you know, you and I might be in an old folks home. I might be there sooner than later, but by the time we really start to see some of this, but it's really tough to ignore that, you know, when the Toronto Raptors were playing on the road to the NBA championship, like there were something like 25,000 people gathered in Mosaic Stadium in Regina to watch on the big screen. Like there were street parties and bars and gatherings. Like in my hometown of Burlington, Ontario, they put up a big screen at City Hall to watch a basketball game. And I can tell you, when I was a kid, that wasn't going to happen.
Right.
That was a 1972 moment for lots of kids.
Yep.
Right? Like lots of kids, Kawhi Leonard jerseys, Spicy P, Kyle Lowry. That was a big moment. And we're not going to really fully realize what just happened here for years and years. Like Vince Carter was an exceptional basketball player here for 3 years. And now we're seeing like Jamal Murray was a huge Vince Carter fan. And now he is one of the most electric players in the NBA. And you see all of, they call them Vince's kids and all these Canadians who are now in the NBA. Like outside of the United States, I believe Canada is the second most populous or most well-represented country in the NBA right now. So imagine the size of Southern Ontario, the reach the Raptors had. Like they set viewership records, people watching the NBA on Canadian soil become successful and continue to be successful again this year. Imagine what the knock-on effect of that is going to be. And it's not just basketball, it is soccer. So, you know, if, you know, Canada becomes an also-ran country, if you can't peg the Maple Leaf to saying, we're going to win gold, this is our game, Bobby Clark, old time hockey, blah, blah, blah. What do you got? You got an expensive sport. You got Canadian polo. Like you got, you got players, you got players and you take a look. And again, like I'm not blaming them. I'm not trying to wealth shame anybody, but you just have to take a look at some of the kids who are in the NHL now. Like these are not guys who like Gordie Howe got their first pair of skates and they're rusty out of a neighbor's rucksack.
Playing with road apples and
right. like there's a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs. His dad's a part owner of the Vancouver Whitecaps. Like, you know, there's another kid on the Toronto Maple Leafs whose dad used to own several GTHL franchises. Like these are not rags to riches stories anymore. This is not, you know, a group of Canadians from small mining towns that Tom Cochran sang about in Big League.
Right.
These are kids who come from privileged backgrounds, from wealthy parents who can afford lots of stuff. And I'm not putting myself above this frame. Both my kids are in hockey school. Both my kids have access to power skating and all that stuff. And because they inherited my genetics, neither of them is going to go on to amount of amount to a lick of anything. But it's just a matter of keeping up, having fun and staying with their friend group. And that means you got to pay some money to play. So that's what it is. It's not broadly accessible anymore.
Do you think that has any tie to the lack of success of NHL teams across they say that the Leafs, when they were so bad for as long as they've been bad, lost an entire generation of fans while the internet exploded and kids could just choose to watch the Penguins instead or the Capitals or whoever was, you know, their favorite player. Do you think it's tied to a lack of success at all, or is it just more the changing dynamic in this country?
I have an interesting question for you, and we'll never find out the answer.
Oh, good. But, so you can't prove me wrong if I answer this
question. But say the Maple Leafs win a Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
And we'll never know for sure.
Right.
But say the Maple Leafs win the Stanley Cup. Would their victory parade be larger or smaller than what the Raptors had last year?
Outside COVID?
Honestly.
No, I know. I'm with you. And I've had that conversation with friends before. It's hard to imagine that it would be bigger than what the Raptors had. I don't know that it's substantially smaller? Do people start driving in from Sudbury and North Bay and whatever just to be a part of it? The mining towns, as we've referenced? I don't know. But I have a hard time believing it's bigger.
Yeah.
What the Raptors did was incredible. And your point there that was a 72 moment for a lot of kids is fascinating. Like, I was just talking a week or two ago to my mom, who remembers, you know, her school letting them watch game 8 when Paul Henderson scored. For a lot of kids, this will be the biggest moment in their young sports fandom, right? In a far more popular league, I guess, far more worldwide sport, the Toronto Raptors were the center of attention. Man, I don't know that the Leaf Parade would be bigger than the Raptors Parade. I tend to doubt it.
And if you had said that 10 years ago, people would have shut down this podcast and you'd already be reported to the authorities, right? But like that you take a look at Jurassic Park and you take a look at Maple Leaf Square and you take a look at those pictures and you say, which one represents Toronto, which one represents Canada?
Yeah.
One represents a Canada of about 50 years ago and one represents Canada of today and tomorrow.
It's true.
One has a future, one doesn't.
Wow. As we said.
So how do you fix it? How do you fix it? Like, that's the thing is, you know, and it sounds like it's all doomsday. And if it doesn't change course, it will be. But, you know, the optimistic part of this is that the Hockey Brain Trust at Hockey Canada and the OHF and the OMHA, I'm not as familiar with Hockey Eastern Ontario, but they recognize that this is a challenge. So the issue now is, how do you go from recognizing a challenge to addressing it? And getting back to Peterborough, they've actually, because, you know, they are now through, you know, I'm not taking any credit for this, but it's all Burton Lee. It's all Burton Lee and his sort of forward thinking on it. They become a leader in this regard. So let me just quick digression of what they've done. Last year, before the world caught fire, the Peterborough Peach, through a woman named Shelby Kilcollins, who works in their front office. She's in her mid-20s. She volunteer coaches. She does everything for the Peach. She came up with this idea of, you know, partnering with the New Canadian Center, which is a not-for-profit center in Peterborough, which is absolutely invaluable. So, you know, if you're new to Canada, they will get your children registered in school. They'll help you get your SIM card. They'll help you get set up everything. If your mom was born in England, you know, 70 years ago, and all of a sudden she realized she didn't get proper paperwork, they will also help. Right. So they're absolutely indispensable. So what Shelby did and what the Peets did was they connected with the New Canadian Center. They said, reach out to your membership and say, if you want to try hockey, if you just want to get on skates, put a hockey stick in your hand, and you're just kind of curious, come on down to the Memorial Center before a game against the London Knights or whoever it was that day. And we're going to give you free tickets, and we're going to get you out there in equipment, and we're going to let you play for 45 minutes just to goof around, and we'll have people out there to help you move around.
Right.
So what Shelby did was she went around, she raided the Pete's sort of storeroom and got all their old skates, as many helmets and gloves as she could find and sticks. And then she went around to everybody who worked with the Peets or sponsored the Peets and said, give me your old gear. And then she drove around to old rinks into their lost and found and gathering all that old stuff. She'd drive around town at like 10 o'clock at night in the middle of a snowstorm because somebody put on Kijiji. They had a free pair of skates. And then she got the Pee Wee girls team that she coaches to come out and volunteer on a rare night off during the hockey season to basically work as, you know, that elbow you can hold on to as you wobble around the skates the first time, right? So what, and then on top of that, they got Tim Hortons to deliver coffee and hot chocolate and donuts and bagels. And they had all of these sticks and skates and helmets and gloves. And they had, you know, I think it was somewhere between 60 and 100 people out to try hockey for the very first time.
Wow.
And it went from, you know, age 6 to, you know, there was a couple that had gray hair on the ice, just giving it a try and going out there. And it was like saying, you know, this is the Peterborough Memorial Center. This is our home. You're in Peterborough. Welcome home. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Something so simple.
Yeah.
And then they gave them tickets and said, here you go. Go have a hot dog with your kids. So the next step for that is connecting with the local hockey association, the Peterborough Hockey Association, to say, okay, we now have that triangle of the Peterborough Peets, the Peterborough Hockey Association, and the New Canadian Center. Let's make something work. Let's create a place where we can get folks who are interested in trying hockey, just taking those first few steps, and get them interested, get them into the rink, and then hand them off to the Peterborough Hockey Association, which will create meaningful learn-to-play programming and make it accessible and interesting so that folks can come in and try it and not have to get right into the craziness that the rest of us do and learn to love the game at their own space.
Love it. Right? I like it. And I like
it. Now, how do you scale that up to a country as big and broadly geographically diverse as Canada? I don't know. But this is one example of how Peterborough is trying to make it work. And I can tell you that the NHL has been made aware of what's going on in Peterborough. And, you know, this could potentially, if it works, hopefully turn into a program that you might be seen rolled out, you know, across North America, really.
Well, should be. I know the PA does some work with their, was it something in dreams?
Goals and Dreams goals or something. But it's, again, the scale is the issue.
Yes, exactly.
There's only so many people they can reach.
Yeah. But the NHL should be taking an interest in this because it's an existential threat to them. If, you know, even with things that we haven't talked about, climate change, right? There's no ponds anymore. How many lakes freeze over and whatever, like little places like that where you could just go for free and just slap the puck around with your friends are going away. And so if you want to survive as a league, you better be engaging new fans and trying to make sure that that fan base continues to grow. And that program in Peterborough is... That sounds incredible. Like, and it's going to take people like Shelby who, you know, are willing to put in that kind of time and effort and push it forward. And those people, they don't grow on trees. So, but I like go ahead. Sorry.
Peterborough, like, and again, I'm not saying this, you know, part of this happened when I was writing the book and part of it's happened, you know, subsequently since I've written the book, but like Peterborough was also the first team in the Canadian Hockey League to make an effort and actually successfully pull off a full-on citizenship ceremony on the ice before a game.
Yeah.
Like, and they felt that was important. That wasn't for PR. That was a symbolic act that they felt was important to say, you know, welcome to Canada, welcome to Peterborough. Again, feel free to call this your home as well.
Right.
And this is where generations of people from Peterborough have congregated as a community. Welcome to this community. Welcome home.
Right. The last thing I wanted to talk to you about, a little bit away from the book, although maybe not completely unrelated, was you did recently write a piece in The Athletic about the struggles of the National Hockey League's ratings, mainly in the Stanley Cup final, but throughout the playoffs. And I can remember speaking to my usual co-host here when this was starting, and I really wondered, despite how much we missed hockey, how the ratings would do once Canadian teams fell out. And I can tell you, as a Leaf fan, who normally, after the Bruins eliminate my team, has to take a round off, but I'm normally back for the conference finals and the finals. And I had a really hard time getting back into it this time. And I think part of it is Canadian summers are very short, and we're used to hockey being kind of wrapped up no later than Canada Day with everything, and then we're outside and we're enjoying all of that. I watched a ton of hockey that first weekend where there was games from noon till 1 a.m. and I was watching the Leafs. And once it was over, I was just kind of, I don't know, it's not hockey time anymore. What did you make of the low ratings for the Stanley Cup final? Was it the teams? Was it the time of year? Was people's minds on other things? Probably a lot of these things, I guess. But
you're right. Yeah, it's all of the above, plus a global pandemic. That whole thing. Like, I think one of the first games was that first weekend in August, and it was Edmonton and Chicago in that qualifying series.
Yeah.
And game one was at 3 p.m. Eastern time on a Saturday in August. So that's noon Pacific.
Yeah.
That game outdrew game two of the Stanley Cup final, which was on a Monday night in September.
Yeah. Wow.
That there are 850,000 Canadians who tuned in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern to watch the Oilers and Blackhawks in a play-in game, as opposed to 842,000 who watched on a Monday night in September. I think part of that, yes, it's the fact that, you know, Dallas and Tampa Bay, they have great players, obviously, but generally, who cares?
Right.
There's no Connor McDavid. There's no Alex Ovechkin. There's no Sidney Crosby. There's none of those, you know, sort of transcendent superstars who are going to make you tune in and watch. And the Canadian teams have been out for basically a month. I think Vancouver went out September 2nd or September 4th. You're not going to watch. The Canadian teams are key to driving that interest. But again, I think it does speak to the point of, like, we got other stuff to do. We're not you know, Pavlovian response isn't to tune into HockeyNet in Canada just because it's on anymore.
Yeah. Do you think this maybe speaks to the idea that we're not necessarily a hockey loving country as much as we're an our team loving country? Is there something to that? I know when Sportsnet first got the rights, Saturday night was supposed to be, you can watch any game, and that lasted like one, maybe 2 years, and they're like, yeah, never mind. Here's your Jets and your Habs and your, like, is there a relationship there, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's probably a limit to how much hockey. Like, I'm not going to tune into City TV to watch the Panthers play the Nashville Predators.
Right.
So there's that. But yeah, I think it is that the Canada of 2020 is not the Canada that, you know, people who were alive to see the 72 Summit Series, it's not the same Canada. There are other things to do today.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, maybe we don't fully have a handle on, you know, just how many people live and die with hockey anymore. I bet you, I don't know how you'd accurately represent those numbers outside of a survey, but I don't think that hockey already has anywhere near the same pull that it might have even a generation ago.
I've really enjoyed this. I appreciate you making some time. Tell people where they can find the book or about the book.
Before the Lights Go Out, Penguin Random House, McClellan Stewart. It's out in hardcover. It's out in Kindle. That's available on Amazon, or it's also available if you feel like venturing out with a mask. The paperback is out in Indigo and any good bookstore across Canada.
Great stocking stuffer. That is Sean Fitzgerald of The Athletic. I really appreciate you making some time for me today, man. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for having me.
That has been another episode of the Tall Can Audio Podcast. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Tall Can Audio, Facebook.com/Tall Can Audio. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you're listening to this one. And we'll catch you all next time.
It is over!
Now that's a tasty beverage.
Thanks for listening. You can get more TCA at TallCanAudio.com or by searching Tall Can Audio on your favorite podcast app.